This is September 16th, 2007, and I will be reading from an article about Mother Teresa, her crisis of faith. This was sent to me by Sevan Sensei a couple weeks ago. It's from Time Magazine, the August 23rd issue of Time Magazine. And it's called, the title is Mother Teresa's Crisis of Faith. And it is so much in here that relates to spiritual practice, religious practice, and Zen practice, that I felt it was very rich with commentary possibilities. I think I'll need to make this into two teishos. It's that long, and bring in other material. But we'll just get started today with this. It begins, the article begins, the article is by David Van Bima. And it begins with his relating about her receiving the Nobel Peace Prize in 1979. She was known as the saint, sometimes known by among some as the saint of the gutters for her work in Calcutta. And she goes to Oslo to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. By the way, if anyone else is confused about where the Nobel Prizes are, I finally learned a year or two ago when I was in Sweden that all of the Nobel Prizes are awarded in Sweden except for the Peace Prize, which is in Oslo. Alfred Nobel was a Swede, and that's why most of them are there, but he stipulated that in the future, the Peace Prize would have to be, couldn't be in Sweden. It would have to be in Oslo because the Swedes were such a warlike people. This is a long time ago that he said this. So it's in Oslo that she went to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And it quotes her. It's not important, I think, in terms of this teisho, what she said is pretty much standard devotional thing about Christ and God. But then it says that less than 3 months earlier, in a letter to a spiritual confidant, the Reverend Michael van der Peet, that is only now being made public, she wrote with weary familiarity of a different Christ, an absent one. In this letter to this reverend, she said, "Jesus has a very special love for you," she said to him, "but as for me, the silence and the emptiness is so great that I look and do not see, listen and do not hear. The tongue moves in prayer but does not speak. I want you to pray for me, that I let him have a free hand." And this is big news. You know, she's been already been beatified and has been nominated for canonization as a saint. And I think to many people, especially to many Catholics, this will be a shock to know that she, in her private life, she had tremendous doubt about her faith and felt really quite desolate for half a century. Let me set it all up with a bit of the chronology of this. The case is this suggests a startling portrait in self-contradiction, that one of the great human icons of the past 100 years, whose remarkable deeds seemed inextricably connected to her closeness to God, and who was routinely observed in silent and seemingly peaceful prayer by her associates as well as a television camera, was living out a very different spiritual reality privately, an arid landscape from which the deity had disappeared. And in fact, that appears to be the case. This is from a new book called Mother Teresa, Come Be My Light. And it consists primarily of correspondence between Teresa and her confessors and superiors over a period of 66 years. Many of these letters were preserved against her wishes. She had requested that they be destroyed, but this was overruled by her church. And they reveal that for the last half century of her life, she felt no presence of God whatsoever. Or as the book's compiler and editor writes, neither in her heart or in the Eucharist. That absence seems to have started at almost precisely the time she began tending the poor and dying in Calcutta. And, except for a 5-week break in 1959, never abated. Although perpetually cheery in public, the Teresa of the letters lived in a state of deep and abiding spiritual pain. In more than 40 communications, many of which have never before been published, she bemoans the, quote, dryness, darkness, loneliness, and torture she is undergoing. She compares the experience to hell, and at one point says it has driven her to doubt the existence of heaven and even of God. She is acutely aware of the discrepancy between her inner state and her public demeanor. The smile, she writes, is a mask or a cloak that covers everything. Similarly, she wonders whether she is engaged in verbal deception. Quote, I spoke as if my very heart was in love with God, tender, personal love, she remarks to an advisor. If you were there, you would have said, what hypocrisy. And then the article here quotes a priest, the editor of a Jesuit magazine called America, and the author of a book called My Life with the Saints. This guy says, I've never read a saint's life where the saint has such an intense spiritual darkness. No one knew she was that tormented. And then the author here goes on to say the book isn't the work of some anti-religious investigative reporter who dumpster dive for Teresa's correspondence. this author, his name is Kolodijuk, is responsible for petitioning for her sainthood and collecting the supporting materials. And the letters in this book were gathered as part of that process. The article here refers to the Spanish mystic St. John of the Cross in the 16th century, who coined the term the dark night of the soul to describe a characteristic stage in the growth of some spiritual masters. It goes on to say that Teresa's may be the most extensive such case on record. And it says in parentheses that for another of the saints, St. Paul of the Cross, this dark night in the 18th century, this dark night lasted 45 years. He ultimately recovered. And as we know, Teresa found ways to live with it and didn't abandon either her belief or her work. And the author of this book, Mother Teresa, Come Be My Light, this Kolodijuk, produced the book as proof of the faith-filled perseverance that he sees as her most spiritually heroic act. The article says, Come Be My Light is that rare thing, a posthumous autobiography that could cause a wholesale reconsideration of a major public figure, one way or another. It raises questions about God and faith, the engine behind great achievement, and the persistence of love, divine and human. That it does so not in any organized, intentional form, but as a hodgepodge of desperate notes not intended for daylight, should leave readers only more convinced that it is authentic. So this is just a little chronology of her life as a nun. She spent 17 years as a teacher in Calcutta with the Loreto Sisters, which is an uncloistered, education-oriented community based in Ireland. And then after these 17 years teaching in Calcutta, she was still just 36, this was in 1946. She had been working herself sick, and her superiors ordered her to relax during her annual retreat in the Himalayan foothills. So close, yet so far away. And then on the ride out to the foothills of the Himalayas, she reported that Christ spoke to her. He called her to abandon teaching and work instead in the slums of the city, dealing directly with the poorest of the poor, the sick, the dying, beggars, and street children. The article says it was wildly audacious, an unfunded, single-handed crusade. Teresa stipulated that she and her nuns would share their beneficiaries' poverty and started out alone. It is quite a remarkable, bold, and really a tremendous demonstration of faith. We see here, just in this, way back in 1946, when she began this mission, she already was someone of great faith and great determination. She just kept hammering away at her superiors. They didn't want to let her do this. They were skeptical. But her letters to this local archbishop illustrate two linked characteristics: extreme tenacity and a profound personal bond to Christ. When this archbishop hesitated, Teresa, calling herself a little nothing, bombarded him with notes. Does anyone see the irony of that? You know the joke. Look who's nothing. While calling herself a little nothing, bombarded him with notes suggesting that he refer the question to an escalating list of authorities. The local apostolic delegation, her mother general, the Pope. And when she felt all else had failed, she revealed the spiritual topper, a dramatic dialogue with a voice, capital V, she eventually revealed to be Christ's. It ended with Jesus' emphatic reiteration of his call to her. You are, I know, the most incapable person. This is Jesus talking. The most incapable person, weak and sinful, but just because you are that, I want to use you for my, capital M, glory. Wilt thou refuse? And she had visions of herself conversing with Christ on the cross, and finally their superiors relented. After consulting the Vatican, they gave permission for her to embark on her second calling. And that was where the shit hit the fan for poor Mother Teresa. She began with a basic medical course in 1948 before launching herself alone onto the streets of Calcutta. At that first first fine careless rapture, she wrote, "My soul at present is in perfect peace and joy." And she described her first day on the job, how fulfilling it was. But 2 months later, this is still 1948, 2 months later, shortly after her major triumph of locating a space for her headquarters, she wrote, "What tortures of loneliness. I wonder how long will my heart suffer this." The author here says the complaint could be understood as an initial response to solitude and hardship were it not for subsequent letters. The more success Teresa had, and half a year later, so many young women had joined her society that she needed to move again, the more success she had, the worse she felt. She would appreciate what Gandhi wrote about progress. He said, "The goal ever recedes from us. The greater the progress, the greater the recognition of our unworthiness. Satisfaction lies in the effort, not the attainment. Full effort is full victory." Five years later, she was still in this state, and she wrote the Archbishop, "Please pray specially for me that I may not spoil his work and that our Lord may show himself, for there is such terrible darkness within me, as if everything was dead. It has been like this more or less from the time I started the work." This Archbishop wrote back, "God guides you, dear mother. You are not so much in the dark as you think. You have exterior facts enough to see that God blesses your work. Feelings are not required and often may be misleading." Feelings are not required and often may be misleading. This is where I want to relate this to practice. Zen practice, we have to find our way beyond the ups and downs of our feelings about ourselves and our practice. Feelings are not the ground of the mind. Feelings come and go. And as long as we are pitched about by our feelings, we will be vulnerable. One of the benchmarks of a mature practice is that one is not susceptible to feelings of success or failure or personal success or failure. A Chinese master said, "Hardship and ease alternate. Therein lies the way." It's the nature of practice. Any serious religious practice, spiritual practice, is subject to the waxing and waning of ardor, of faith, and really the interplay of faith and doubt. It's the nature of practice. It's the nature of the journey. We go through periods of darkness and light. The author writes, "And yet feelings, or rather their lack, became her life's secret torment. How can you assume the lover's ardor when he no longer grants you his voice, his touch, his very presence? The problem was exacerbated by an inhibition to even describe it. Teresa reported on several occasions inviting a confessor to visit and then being unable to speak. Eventually, one of them thought to ask her to write the problem down, and she complied. "The more I want him," she wrote, "the less I am wanted." A year later, she sounded desolate. Such deep longing for God, and repulsed, empty, no faith, no love, no zeal. The saving of souls holds no attraction. Heaven means nothing. Pray for me, please, that I keep smiling at him in spite of everything. I'm reminded here of states that we can get into, especially in Sesshin. Sesshin is so intense with so much sitting each day that it accelerates this waxing and waning of faith and doubt. And can throw right in our faces our doubts. I've had so many people come to me in Doksan late in Sesshin and report a feeling of flatness, of emptiness in the desolate kind of emptiness, where they just feel they can't kickstart the enthusiasm, the ardor that brought them to Sesshin, that it's just sort of like a balloon that's been pierced. It just, the air has gone out of their practice, and it's very discouraging. I, of course, have been through that myself in Sesshin. But if they can dig deep, and even in that desolation, that feeling of just blahness, they can just keep with the sitting and with the practice, and not give way to the voices that are saying this is pointless. What is this all for anyway? But just to not attend to those voices, but just stay with the practice as best one can, which may be very meager in that state, then one will pull out of it. It is so common to go through this, and it is a great test of one's faith. Mother Teresa, my sense from reading this painful account is that she had very little silence in her, very little stillness. Her life was one unending crusade of activity to help others, which is wonderful. She's a tremendous example of compassion and action. But it seemed unbalanced. She didn't have the inner experience. She didn't have the detachment that would have leavened her crusade. We get some support for that hypothesis because in hearing that she had worked herself almost to, no, not to death, but that reference earlier where she had been working so hard that her superiors had urged her to get away, and so she was a very driven person. And there's something missing, there's something unbalanced about that. her success and her mission and her winning this Nobel Peace Prize is testimony to her tremendous effort, her tremendous energy. More about her, this long, long, long dark night of the soul. She frequently bemoaned an inability to pray. These are her words. I utter words of community prayers and try my utmost to get out of every word, the sweetness it has to give. But my prayer of union is not there any longer. I no longer pray. I can't imagine doing what she did, accomplishing what she did, without the balance of meditation or prayer. Her life seems to have been a life of just pure doing, without the other side. There was one period when she got a break from this terrible darkness and doubt. In 1958, that was after 10 years of it, the Pope died, Pope Pius XII, and masses were celebrated around the Catholic world. Teresa prayed to the deceased Pope for a proof that God is pleased with the society. That is her mission. And then and there, she rejoiced, disappeared the long darkness, that strange suffering of 10 years. But 5 weeks later, she reported being, quote, in the tunnel once more. And it never lifted again. Five years after her Nobel Prize, a Jesuit priest in the Calcutta province noted that Mother came to speak about the excruciating night in her soul. It was not a passing phase, but had gone on for years. A 1995 letter discussed her spiritual dryness, and then she died in 1997, 10 years ago. I think of some wonderful words by a 16th century German scholar and religious reformer by the name of Philip Melanchthon. And this is what he said. One often preaches his beliefs precisely when he has lost them and is looking everywhere for them. And on such occasions, his preaching is by no means at its worst. The article here then goes on to pose the question, looking for an explanation of how this could have happened to her. That initial inspiration that got her to persistently petition her superiors for the founding of this society, and then suddenly it evaporated. the author of that book that this article is about, finds divine purpose in the fact that Teresa's spiritual spigot went dry just as she prevailed over her church's perceived hesitations and saw a successful way to realize Jesus' call for her. That author said she was a very strong personality, and a strong personality needs stronger purification as an antidote to pride. As proof that it worked, he cites her written comment after receiving an important prize in the Philippines in the 1960s. "This means nothing to me," she said, "because I don't have him." And yet, this author writes, the question is, who determined the abandonment she experienced? Well, we know that, those of us in Zen. Who else could have but she herself? They quote a psychoanalyst here, who asks, could she have imposed it on herself? Duh. Psychologists have long recognized that people of a certain personality type are conflicted about their high achievement and find ways to punish themselves. Teresa's ambitions for her ministry were tremendous. She said, "I want to love Jesus as he has never been loved before." To which a certain priest remarked, "That's a kind of a daring thing to say." Yeah, well, we could say, egoistic! Yet her letters are full of inner conflict about her accomplishments. And then it offers other psychological explanations of why the sudden evaporation of faith, why the sudden darkness that lasted so long. I won't go into those. It does say that the atheist explanation is simpler. Remember Christopher Hitchens from my last Taisho? Those of you who may not have heard that, Christopher Hitchens seems to be a hardcore atheist who has been spending years now trying to debunk any religious faith that he comes across. He wrote a book about her. I've been told that portrays her as quite a difficult person. Ill-tempered, grouchy, I don't know what else. And this Christopher Hitchens likens her to die-hard Western communists late in the Cold War. He said there was a huge amount of cognitive dissonance. They thought, Jesus, the Soviet Union is a failure, but I'm not supposed to think that. It means my life is meaningless. They carried on somehow, he says, but the mainspring was gone. And I think once the mainspring is gone, it cannot be repaired. Oh, that is a statement. It has to be a statement of someone without faith. He's referring to the mainspring of religious faith, which he would be the first to say he doesn't have. But the real mainspring, he is quite well, even in him, even in Christopher Hitchens. It is this self nature, this Buddha mind, this original nature that is common to all of us. It doesn't have to be repaired because it has never been broken and never could be broken. It is our nature. Faith is our nature, and yes, it gets obscured, it goes dry at times. But we wouldn't do anything without faith. Getting up in the morning is an expression of faith. When Christopher Hitchens gets up each morning, that's what gets him up, is some kind of faith in something. His most, probably Christopher Hitchens' most notable faith is his faith in the in materialism, in skepticism. Then the author of this article goes on to say, most religious readers will reject that explanation, along with any that makes her the author of her own misery, or even defines it as true misery. Well, how could you not define, what is it if it's not misery? 50 years of what she describes as in terms of darkness and bleakness and emptiness. One of the religious commentators characterizes her, Mother Teresa, as kind of a being in a torch song, carrying the torch for Jesus and never having it requited. And this guy said he counter proposes her as the heroically constant spouse. This is what he says. Let's say you're married and you fall in love and you believe with all your heart that marriage is a sacrament. And your wife, God forbid, gets a stroke and she's comatose and you will never experience her love again. It's like loving and caring for a person for 50 years and once in a while you complain to your spiritual director, but you know on the deepest level that she loves you even though she's silent and that what you're doing makes sense. Mother Teresa knew that what she was doing made sense. Yeah, I would agree, but she knew it in with her body. Not but, and she knew it with her body. She knew it in a way that was beyond ordinary, the kind of faith that stands against doubt. She evidently didn't need faith in that superficial sense. Because look at what she did in her life. Her life was a demonstration of faith, even though her letters were full of doubt. How could she have done what she did? It's tremendous, tremendous work for so long without faith. A disciple once asked the Chinese master Xiang Yan, what is Tao? What is the way? Xiang Yan said, in the dry woods, the dragon is singing. The author goes on to say there are two responses to trauma: to hold onto it in all its vividness and remain its captive, or without necessarily conquering it, to gradually integrate it into the day by day. After more than a decade of open wound agony, Teresa seems to have begun regaining her spiritual equilibrium with the help of a particularly perceptive advisor. It was the Reverend Joseph Nooner, whom she met in the late 1950s and confided in later. He was already a well-known theologian, and when she turned to him with her darkness, he seems to have told her the three things she needed to hear. And let's go through these. First, that there was no human remedy for it. That is, she should not feel responsible for affecting it. I think in Zen terms, this is very wise statement. The opposite understanding is to think that we can control everything, and that we ourselves are the controllers. That we with responsibility, with this illusion of control, that we can just control of all of our moods, our feelings, our faith, and our doubt. With that comes responsibility and the burden of feeling that we have failed, that we have to do something. If you go to Sesshin long enough, or if you practice long enough, it's outside Sesshin, you eventually come to see through this illusion of control, that we can decide at any given time how our practice is going. There are so many influences that are beyond our control. It's a conceit to think that we're responsible for our doubts or for our failures, so-called failures in practice. We are not apart from others. We are vulnerable to so many things. There is just this one mind. It is an illusion to think that our mind is separate from others, and therefore we can pull the strings on everything. We partake of others' confusion and doubt and darkness and moods. This is an aspect of understanding no self. There is no self apart. No one of us is an island. We absorb, we reflect, we are not apart from the disturbances in other people's minds. And the sooner we can stop blaming ourselves for the ups and downs in our practice, the more chance we have of it really, of us getting free of all that. Ultimately, we don't need an explanation, really, for these things if we have the faith to just return to the practice and stop trying to find the cause of it. The second thing that this reverend told her was that feeling Jesus is not the only proof of his being there, and her very craving for God was a sure sign of his hidden presence in her life. Well, that's true. She was about as close to a Christ figure in terms of her outer work in the world as you could find. And moreover, besides what we already said about her tremendous commitment to her work, her devotion to the poor and the starving in Calcutta, her very craving, as this reverend says, her very craving for God was a sure sign of his hidden presence in her life. It's the same with mu, with our koan, with the breath. And people actually also, people working on the breath come to a point sometimes where they can't find their breath. That shows what a spectacular makyo it is that they can't find their breath. And their distress over that, their feeling of wanting to, or wanting to get back to mu, or who, or whatever one's practice is, that very wanting is the proof of the health and the well-being of one's essential nature. And the third thing this priest told her was that the absence of Christ in her life was in fact part of the spiritual side of her work for Jesus. And what he meant by that, I'll elaborate, the author elaborates on here. This counsel from this reverend clearly granted Teresa a tremendous sense of release. for all that she had expected and even craved to share in Christ's passion, she had not anticipated that she might recapitulate the particular moment on the cross when he asks, my God, why have you forsaken me?" She suddenly realized, with this priest's help, that she was living that very passion, that anguish. You can imagine for a Catholic nun how reassuring this would be. The author continues, "The idea that rather than a nihilistic vacuum, his felt absence might be the ordeal she had prayed for, that her perseverance in its face might echo his faith unto death on the cross, that it might indeed be a grace, enhancing the efficacy of her calling, made sense of her pain." Neuner would later write, this is the priest who pointed this out to her, "It was the redeeming experience of her life when she realized that the night of her heart was the special share she had in Jesus' passion. And she thanked Neuner profusely. I can't express in words the gratitude I owe you for your kindness to me. For the first time in years, I have come to love the darkness." That is faith. The author goes on to say, not that it didn't continue to torment her. Years later, describing the joy in Jesus experienced by some of her nuns, she observed dryly to Neuner, "I just have the joy of having nothing, not even the reality of the presence of God in the Eucharist." She described her soul as like an ice block. Yet she recognized Neuner's key distinction, writing, "I accept not in my feelings, but with my will, the will of God, I accept his will." His will, her will. It was this tremendous force of faith that propelled her through these decades of compassionate service. Although she still occasionally worried that she might, quote, turn a Judas to Jesus in this painful darkness, with the passage of years, the absence morphed from a potential wrecking ball into a kind of ragged cornerstone. And then the psychoanalyst said, "What is remarkable is that she integrated it in a way that enabled her to make it the organizing center of her personality, the beacon for her ongoing spiritual life." The author says, "Certainly she understood it as essential enough to project it into her afterlife. She said, 'If I ever become a saint, I will surely be one of darkness. I will continually be absent from heaven to light the light of those in darkness on earth.'" I think of this story, I don't know if it's true, of a Zen master was once asked, "If you could be reborn anywhere you wanted, where would you be reborn?" And he said, "In hell, because that's where I'd be needed most." The other way she might have gone, had she had any strong enough affinity with Buddhism, is to settle into the emptiness itself, and in doing that, to turn what is a desolate emptiness, emptiness with a small e, into this nothing that is everything. This emptiness with a capital E that is pure potential, pure vibrancy. I think before trying to elaborate more on that, I think we'll have to save that for next week's Teisho. And next week I will step back and look more at this whole interplay of lightness and darkness, light and darkness, that is the journey. So we'll stop now and recite the four vows.